This is Dennis Bernstein, and we're back talking with Pete Bruton, the author of The Mafia, the CIA, and George Bush, recently released by SBI and distributed by Hearst. Pete, let's go to another part of the story. We've been talking about the essence, your investigation, the relationship between the CIA, the mafia, organized crime, if you will, and some of the most powerful politicians and movers and shakers in American corporate life. But there's another story here, and that has to do with the roadblocks and all the hurdles that you had to overcome to gather the material and to actually to get it out into the public eye, both that as a journalist for the Houston Post and then writing first for Simon & Schuster and then ultimately for the publisher that you're with now. So let's start with the Houston Post. I understand that you had a real struggle getting some of the information out. I imagine some of the information that had to do with Walter Mischer. I remember when I first interviewed you, I brought up the subject of Walter Mischer, and you went from a very talkative man to a very silent person. Now, I know that in part that was because you were in the middle of the investigation. I also imagine it was because you couldn't get those stories into your own paper. You want to talk about the struggle you had at the Houston Post?
Sure. And the struggle began way before Walter Mischer. It began at the initial stories that Greg C. and I wrote for the Houston Post about Mainland Savings and some mafia involvement in Mainland Savings. I encountered some resistance from the Post attorneys. The Post law firm that they used to read stories for libel considerations is Fulbright and Jaworski, which is one of the major law firms in this country. Jaworski, of course, was the Leon Jaworski, Watergate prosecutor, very famous man. Fulbright Jaworski is a very powerful law firm, and they are the Houston Post lawyers. And the stories that we wrote for Mainland Savings, the lawyers at Fulbright and Jaworski would read those for libel considerations, and they put up some resistance to some of those. One in particular was about one of these New York money brokers that were involved with Mainland Savings. Greg and I had gone up to New York City. We found that Martin Schwimmer, who was Mario Renda's partner in brokering money all over the United States, the savings and loans. They would collect money from credit unions and pension funds and distribute that and invest it, broker it into savings and loans across the country. And in exchange, they would usually require these SMLs to make loans to their partners. And the first place they got caught was in Kansas City, in the case we talked about, Indian Springs State Bank.
And that was with Farhad Azim and
right.
The head of jail for the CIA.
And
Mario Renda, just to remind people, is the sort of the mob figure who seized on deregulation and even before deregulation to use these SNLs as his own cash cows, brokers really using broker deposits and kickbacks from those deposits.
That's correct. And he was indicted and later convicted on a scheme that involved Mainland Savings. They were brokering union pension funds into Mainland Savings. And the prosecutors in Brooklyn that were going after Renda and Schwimmer, you know, said that they had almost always in found that their deposits were linked to loans. In other words, when Renda and Schwimmer put money in an SNL, they would require that the SNL then make loans to their associates.
Just very briefly say what the broker deposit is.
It's just what I said. They would collect money from credit unions and pension funds and bundle it into $100,000 packages so it was covered by deposit insurance, and then they would basically buy a CD at a savings loan or put that money into a savings loan, and the SNL would then use that money to make loans. I mean, that's where they got a lot of their money.
And that they would require that those loans be made to people who they wanted those loans to be made.
That's correct. Now, one of Renda's associates was Adnan Khashoggi, who got a huge $68 million loan, from Mainland Savings. And here Renda is brokering money in. Well, we didn't know that at the time. Well, we just knew Renda and Schwimmer, and they were tied to the mafia. And we wondered if there were any loans connected to Mario Renda and Martin Schwimmer's deposits in the Mainland. Well, the first rattle out of the box, the first people we were investigating were these New York apartment syndicators who had taken some $100 million out of Mainland. And so here they were from New York, Renda and Schwimmer from New York. We thought maybe this was the connection, maybe there was a link. So we went up to Long Island, to New York City, and to investigate these people. And the head of the apartment syndication group was a man named Howard Pulver. So we went to see him. We finally found him. It took us some while to actually find out where he lived. He lived in Kings Point, Long Island, which was a very ritzy suburb on the north shore of Long Island. And Pulver lived in a house that was secluded. You couldn't see it from the road. He had a no trespassing sign at the front of the road leading to his house. And the name on the mailbox in front of it on the road was someone who hadn't lived there in 13 years. And here we come to this huge mansion. It's got a glass dome over an indoor swimming pool, a pond out in front. Big cars and motorhomes in the parking lot. And we went to talk to Pulver. He gave us 10 seconds to get off his property. So we're investigating, trying to look at the public documents, trying to find any connection between Pulver and Renda. And Pulver had a partner named Tony Padone. So we're looking at connections between Padone and Renda. Couldn't find anything. So then we said, well, let's look at Martin Schwimmer. Let's go talk to him. Schwimmer had been laundering money for the Lucchese mafia crime family, and he was a PhD author. So we go, we find out he lived in Kings Point, too. So we're driving up trying to find Schwimmer's house. We find his the street he lives on. We're driving down the street. We're almost there at his house. We look on the left. We see the back of this huge mansion with a glass dome over it. It's Howard Pulver's house. They're neighbors. They live close to each other in this very secluded area of Kings Point, Long Island. And, we knew we had something there. Here we have Schwimmer brokering maybe $100 million into Mainland Savings, and his Kings Point neighbor taking maybe $100 million out of Mainland Savings. Okay, so we knew that there was likely a connection there. Anyway, Greg and I wrote this big, long story about this, including a lot of background information about Howard Pulver, Mario Renda, and Martin Schwimmer. The attorney at Fulbright Jaworski almost killed that story and got most of the details taken out. I mean, he particularly was defending Howard Pulver. You can't say this about this man and blah, blah, this and that and the other. And it was a very hard just getting the fact in that they were neighbors and had both done business with Mainland Savings. I found out much later that Fulbright Jaworski was representing Howard Pulver's company in a lawsuit at the same time.
I imagine they got Mr. Pulver probably got a phone call very quickly.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to speculate on that, but there was a conflict of interest there. Okay. Then, when I started the CIA stories, they were basically finished in the fall of 1989. It should have run in 1989. And the reason they didn't was because Fulbright Jaworski was protesting and giving us a lot of trouble and saying we couldn't run the stories, particularly on Walter Mischer. I mean, they were trying to make us, they given the argument that Mischer wasn't a public figure, which was absolutely nonsense, and trying to keep the Mischer stuff out. And when we started running the stories eventually in February of 1990, we should have run the Mischer stories first because that's it, that's where it makes sense. You know, it all hinges on Mischer. I mean, you can tie everything that you look at back to Mischer and his circle of you know, powerful Houston businessmen and politicians. And without Mischer, it's hard to make sense out of a lot of this because he's the key. He's the key middleman. And they didn't run Mischer because of what Fulbright Jaworski was, you know, telling them about.
Now, what was the attitude of your editors? Were they just accepting this as, because it didn't sound like it was illegal. They weren't making a legal justification for not running the stories. It was more of a personal and a philosophical.
Well, they were saying that they would not sign off on the stories on Mischer, saying that there were libel problems. So our editors were saying, well, let's go ahead and run this other stuff. You know, we can do that later. So we began running, we had stuff on Corson and Azima and Palmer National Bank. And it was sort of, you know, spread out, run sporadically, rather than as a series, which I protested. I wanted to run it, you know, every day. Let's hit them every day with something new. And as a result of just doing it sporadically, we came in for a lot of criticism because the first two stories we ran were very weak and were only intended to be run as an introduction to the series along with another major story that on a Sunday, then there would be another story on Monday, then another one on Tuesday. And as a result, we got a lot of criticism because people just read the first two stories and said, there's nothing here. There's no details. There's no, you know, backup evidence. And so finally, we got all the stories out by the fall of 1990. And I went back to working on the Mischer stuff to try to get it in. And we had some more corroborating evidence. And, you know, the stories were good. I wrote them. We had a sit-down meeting with Fulbright and Jaworski. They protested again. I answered their objections. The editors said they were going to run the stories. Okay. Finally, though, it came Christmas time, and we were going to run them on December 31st. I was at my parents' ranch at the time, not in Houston, and Fulbright Jaworski lawyers basically would not sign off on the story, and the top editor, who was new, went along with that rather than overrule them. Now, go back to the beginning.
So the lawyers here are becoming the executive editor,
right,
making the final decision.
That's right. You go back to the beginning when Fulbright Jaworski first read the Mischer stories back in the fall of 89. We had a sit-down meeting with the junior associate there at Fulbright Jaworski, and he starts criticizing the stories in very strong language, and not language like he usually uses, very mild-mannered person. And so, you know, it started ringing bell. You know, it set off alarms with me. And I said, I asked him immediately, does Fulbright Jaworski have any conflicts of interest with these stories? You know, because something else was going on. Wasn't normal behavior, regardless of what the content of the story was. He just did not act that way. And he said not that he knows of, and that they had done work for M-Bank, and M-Bank was, of course, financing a lot of Herman K. Beebe's stuff, but that M-Bank no longer existed and had been taken over by another bank, and so he didn't think they had any conflicts of interest. Well, they did. They had big-time conflicts of interest. And he either did not check on it like he had a duty to check, particularly when I asked him. And if he checked, he'd found that they were representing Walter Mischer's company in a wrongful death suit. At the same time, they were killing Walter Mischer's stories at the Houston Post. They had represented Walter Mischer's company previously in a lawsuit. And I found out recently, if you call up Fulbright and Jaworski and you ask to speak to the attorney who handles Walter Mischer's interests, you're referred to an attorney in their San Antonio office who coordinates litigation for a Mischer company there. So they had conflicts of interest, and they either didn't research it. If they did, they didn't tell us about it.
Okay, share what... you must have been pretty angry at this point.
I was furious.
Could you share what was the dialogue? Did you go and bring this to your editors?
Well, what happened was when I was told, you know, around New Year's Day, or shortly before that, that Fulbright Jaworski would not sign off on the stories, and that they weren't going to run them, you know, I exploded and I said, I bet this attorney, who was a junior associate at the time, his job is on the line. If he can't stop these stories, he won't make partner at Fulbright Jaworski. Well, 6 weeks later, I'd taken a leave. After they didn't run the stories, I took a leave of absence to write the book. 6 weeks later, I'm sitting in a restaurant with two of the top editors of the Post, and one of them told me, "Hey, guess what? This junior associate we're talking about just got made a partner at Fulbright Jaworski." So that's when I started looking in depth at Fulbright Jaworski for conflicts of interest. I found a lot more. Fulbright Jaworski's Washington office represented Palmer National Bank in a securities offering.
This is the bank that was
financed by Herman KBB, tied in with intelligence operations.
This channel, Contras.
Right. And here they were. Fulbright Jaworski is representing them. A number of other conflicts of interest I found. Fulbright Jaworski, through the MD Anderson Foundation, had laundered money for the CIA. They had represented, they had been involved in a land deal involving Herman KBB. So I took all this information to the Houston Post editors and told them about it. I thought that they needed to know this, what I'd found out, and I shouldn't just sit on this information. Well, guess what the Houston Post did when I told them about it? Nothing. They apparently questioned one of the lawyers about it. He gave them some legal mumbo jumbo that turned out not to be accurate, and they were apparently satisfied with that and continue to use Fulbright and Jaworski. And that was one of the reasons I did not go back to the Houston Post, because anything I wrote would have to go through Fulbright and Jaworski.
Did you ask your editors? Or did you ask them about how this might compromise the nature of freedom of the press, the open flow of information? Did you get into this dialogue at all?
Not much. I mean, I probably would have said, you know, we've just turned this newspaper over to Fulbright and Jaworski, you know, and they didn't respond to it.
Why were they so willing? Why wouldn't they change law firms? Why were they so... Was this the only law firm in town? Why did they need this law firm?
It's a fairly long story. I'm not sure it's particularly relevant. I mean, the Hobby family in Houston used to own the Houston Post. Ovita Culp Hobby was a very influential woman in Houston. She had been in FDR's cabinet. She had married a Texas governor, William P. Hobby. Her son became the lieutenant governor of Texas and was lieutenant governor for many years, Bill Hobby. And in 1983, I believe, they sold the Houston Post to a group of Canadians that had the Toronto Star, Toronto Sun. Really interesting and good people. We had a lot of fun working for the Canadians. And when the Hobby family left, one of their people told the Canadians that they should get Fulbright Jaworski for their lawyers. And the Canadians hired them on their recommendation. And when William Dean Singleton bought the Houston Post from the Canadians, he kept Fulbright Jaworski on. Fulbright Jaworski is a very influential, powerful firm, and they can protect you from a lot of things. And I think that the Post liked to have that protection. I mean, there were some times
it was demonstrated here that the law firm was acting not in the best interest of the paper or the people who read the paper, but just on their own conflict of interest. I mean, didn't yes. that concern them that this might be a problem in the future?
I, you know, got no sense that that concerned them very much. And as I say, that's one of the reasons I didn't go back there.
Besides it turning it over to the law firm, what you know, just a little bit on a more philosophical level, what does that mean for freedom of speech, freedom of the press? What does that mean?
Well, you know, it's just, it's terrible. I mean, the lawyers become the ultimate editors rather than journalists. And lawyers have entirely different ways of thinking about things, entirely different motives, entirely different ends than journalists do. I mean, our function is to get information out to the public. Lawyers' functions is sort of to handle disputes between people. And, you know, the society, our society is not delegated editing functions to lawyers, but it's now come to that.
I have to ask you one. I just have to ask you to speculate with me on one other thing, or maybe just reflect on it. Now, Leon Jaworski was called in after the Saturday Night Massacre in which Richard Nixon had Archibald Cox fired.
Correct.
And we remember that Elliot Richardson resigned in protest, refusing to fire Cox, and then and then there was another one who refused to do it. And then finally it went to Solicitor General Robert Bork, who did fire Archibald Cox.
Yes.
And Leon Jaworski came in.
Yes.
And there was a real limiting of the investigation. And I have to wonder why they went to Jaworski.
Well, I wonder too. And Jaworski obviously had to know about the MD Anderson Foundation laundering money for the CIA. Florian Jaworski ran the MD Anderson Foundation. So he was probably involved, without doubt, in laundering money for the CIA, helping them. By the way, the Hobby Foundation had the Hobby family had a foundation that was also doing the same money laundering for the CIA. So I've had people tell me that they believe that Jaworski had other connections to the CIA. In other words, he represented them in legal matters. And so here we have the same old story. Someone tied into the CIA being brought in to head or lead an investigation that touches on the CIA. And you know, the CIA never got really tied in to Watergate.
And it was interesting that there seemed to be a sort of agreement, we'll let Nixon go, but we're not going to get into the nature of the bombing, the illegal bombings of Cambodia and other related CIA dirty tricks that ultimately were revealed to some degree by Church.
That's
and
correct, Park. Yes.
And it took many more years to get to them.
Right, you know, and Nixon, you remember, tried to threaten the CIA to get them to call off the FBI investigation. And you remember one of the things he threatened them with, he says, you know, this whole Howard Hunt Cuban thing could come out. And there was a lot of speculation, and still is, about what exactly does he mean by that. And some people think he was talking about the CIA hiring the mafia to kill Castro. And, you know, that, if that came out, I mean, that's something that just is outrageous. I mean, an agency of this government hiring organized criminals to do things. And, of course, that came out during the church committee.
And these names came up again in your book.
Yes, that's right. That's
country.
Right.
I mean, it's the same.
Frank Sturgis and some of these people.
All right. Now, that wasn't the only roadblock. So there you were. Leaving the Houston Post to write a book. You were called to New York. You were solicited by the president of Simon & Schuster. By the way, this brings us back to Watergate and part of that story. It's sort of one big story here. And you were called in. I guess they saw some of the articles that were being published in the Post, and they had some interest in you writing a book based on these articles.
Yes. The way it happened, you know, I'm not sure if it... You know, you can read anything into it, but one of their editors called me and said his father had told him about some of my stories that had appeared in a California alternative newspaper, and he wondered if I could send them to him. So I did. This was the summer of 1990, and we were right in the middle of the story. I think I'd just written the Palmer National Bank story. And I sent that to him. He got back to me and said he'd shown them to their top people, including Alice Mayhew, who was one of their top editors and had edited All the President's Men by Woodward and Bernstein and done a number of best-selling books. And they wanted to talk to me, so they flew me up to New York City, and we had a very nice visit. And I told them basically what I was doing, and I had not given much thought to writing a book, and they had actually solicited me. I didn't have an agent or anything like that. And the next day, Alice Mayhew called me up, said, "We'd like to make you an offer. We'd like to, sign you up on a contract to write a book for us, and we'll pay you $100,000 advance." You know, and my attitude was, where do I sign? I mean, the main reason was that here was considered top editors in the country. Also, I must say, going into this, I knew about the corporate background of Simon & Schuster. The fact that Simon & Schuster was owned and is owned by Paramount Communications. Paramount Communications was the former Gulf and Western, the big conglomerate, that one of the founders was a Houston man named John Duncan. And John Duncan's brother is Charles Duncan, who was the Secretary of Energy, I believe, under Jimmy Carter, and former Associate Secretary of the Defense Department. And these people tie in to the Mischer Circle very closely. Okay? They're connected to Jack Trotter, who is Mischer's very close associate and involved in lots of investments. And one of the board members of Paramount Communications is Hugh Ledke, who is the chairman of the board of Pennzoil and one of George Bush's closest friends and longtime business associates. They had Zapata Petroleum together back in the 50s. And so I knew this going in. And I thought it would just be really poetic justice for Simon & Schuster to do this book. And it turned out to be too good to be true because Simon & Schuster eventually refused to publish the book before the election.
How did that unfold? I mean, here's a publisher that offers you $100,000 advance. Usually it goes, I imagine you got $50,000,
yes,
right away, so you had $50,000 in your pocket.
Yes.
They had gone $50,000 in the red for this book, plus all the time they spent in terms of editors and working back and forth at that level. So how did you find out they didn't want to publish your book?
Well, the book was due, the manuscript was due in the summer of 91, and I sent it in on the deadline date, and about 2 months later, I get a four-page editing letter from Alice Mayhew saying that, it's great material, it's wonderful, in fact, it's even overwhelming, and we think it needs to be restructured or reorganized because it's too hard to understand the way you've got it structured now, and she suggested a way to organize it that I didn't particularly care for, although I saw a similar way to do it. And so I wrote her back and I said, "Well, let me suggest something, an alternative way to do it." And she agreed and wrote me a letter back, wonderful, great. She even said, "We think you've proved what you set out to prove in tracing the lineage of the SNL debacle back to the mafia and the CIA. And she said, "But we think you've done it uneconomically, and the way you suggested, we think will do it." Well, I started working on that, and it didn't work. And I had to do another different type of organization I think works better now. And that took another couple of months. And during this time, I'm in contact with one of Alice Mayhew's associates. And I, by the way, when I was negotiating the contract with Simon & Schuster, I wrote them in writing and I said to them that this book has to come out before the 1990 presidential election because it's got all the stuff on Bush and on Lloyd Benson. And at that time, there was lots of talk about Benson being the Democratic nominee. And they agreed to move up their normal lead time of 18 months to 12 months. So the book had been published in the summer of 92. All right. Now, during this time, when I sent them the manuscript, I reminded them this. In the summer of 91, I said, look, as you can see, this book needs to go. We talked about it needs to go before the presidential election. When I'm doing the restructuring, I contact Alice's assistant, and I'm concerned. I said, I'm concerned that this book be published before the election. I want to make sure we got enough time. And he said, don't worry, we can put it out in 2 months when we get the revised manuscript. He says, no problem. So in February, I submitted the revised manuscript, and I don't hear anything from him, nothing. In the meantime, I've been talking to Steve Pizzo, and he tells me, There's this thing called the fall list that publishers have that they're going to publish in the second half of the year. And if you're not on that, you're not going to get published. So I wanted to make sure, and he said publishers are drawing this list up right now. So I wanted to make sure I was on the list, and I called Alice, and I sent her letters and faxes, and I got no response. And I talked to her assistant, and I said, you know, did you get the manuscript? He said,